Well, hey there. Welcome to Just to Be Nominated, a podcast about movies distributed by Lee Enterprises. The show is hosted by me, Chris Lay, the podcast operations manager for Lee Enterprises, along with Bruce Miller, an entertainment reporter for multiple decades who is currently the editor of the Sioux City Journal, and Jared McNatt, a reporter for the Globe Gazette in Mason City, Iowa. Every episode, each of us pick five of our favorite films on a theme or concept and go back and forth hashing them out. It is a ton of fun for us as big-time movie nerds, and hopefully it will turn you on to some flicks that you might not know about, or maybe give you some insight on movies you already know and love. Last time, we had Turkey on our minds and Last time you heard from us, we had Turkey Time on the mind, and we wrangled up 15 of our favorite foodie films. For this episode that you're hearing right now, we did the obvious thing and decided to talk about Christmas movies. Some of them are certified classics, but others might be new to you, or hey, maybe they didn't even register as holiday fare. Any which way, we hope you dig it. You can check the show notes for links to where you can stream the movies that we talked about and discover older episodes of our show as well. Before we get into things, though, I wanted to make sure that I mentioned that Lee Enterprises has just launched a great new podcast called The Ethical Life. It is hosted by Richard Kite, director of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University, and Scott Rada, Lee's social media manager. The show explores the intersection of ethics and modern life, and it's really wonderful. You can find a link to that in the show notes as well, or, you know, search for it on your pod player of choice. Our show kicks off after this short pause. So yeah, so let's, we can definitely get right into it. First of all, how did you guys have some happy holidays, get some time off, eat some food, watch some stuff?
My mom came up, and that was it. And we did like some takeout and stuff, and then watched the ultimate Thanksgiving movie, which is, of course, The Last Waltz, the Scorsese documentary of the band's last show in 76. And then after that, started a tradition that's like 2 years running now of watching The Irishman to finish off the night. So that was my day for Thanksgiving.
Jared, have you pre-ordered the Criterion Irishman?
Oh, I already have it.
Fantastic.
The one I got so far is a gift for somebody else. I'm waiting on my copy.
But, gotcha. Yeah. You got to think of others first. You know, it's the 'tis the season.
Exactly.
If you have a fight with that person, you just keep it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Speaking of 'tis the season.
Da, 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 da.
We are looking at holiday movies, Christmas movies, movies that have Christmas in them in some way, shape, or form.
Holly jolly Christmas.
It's the best time of the year.
We might get charged. Better not sing too much.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I'm sure the iTunes algorithm is going to be able to identify and based on the few seconds of warbling that just happened.
This year it's a Holly Dolly Christmas because Dolly is doing her own thing.
Yeah, she has had a fascinating 2020 with, between the documentary that hit Netflix recently, the Christmas thing that you're talking about, Bruce, and finding out that she has been funding
COVID research.
Yeah.
I feel like her and like, I don't know, maybe like Tony Hawk or something, or some of the only people left that enjoy like bipartisan love, like from just all sectors of like American society at this point. Cause I don't know anyone that doesn't like Dolly Parton or it has a negative thing to say. Maybe they're neutral, but I don't know anyone that's in the negative when it comes to her at this point.
I mean, she at this point really is just a legitimate American treasure.
I think they could do a statue of her and we'd be fine.
Or if not a statue, just a bust.
Yeah, a bust would be good as long as it's a bust. You need to have some support underneath it, though.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's got to be cantilevered
She is the nicest person, and she is so smart. What a great business person she is. I think that Dollywood must run like oil.
Yeah. It's also impressive to be like a living artist and have a whole like theme park basically centered around you. Like, that's a power move.
Coming soon.
But we've got holiday movies, of which Dolly's is coming out. So it's not going to be on any of our lists.
Give it a year or two. It'll be on the list.
There you go. There you go. Who's going first?
I can go first.
Let's have Jared take the lead on this one.
And this is something I wouldn't have even necessarily thought even a week ago when we were talking about doing this to put on until someone mentioned it. Someone that I'm friends with on Twitter mentioned it, and that's Batman Returns from 1992, which was the second of the Tim Burton Batman movies. And I got excited when I saw that as a suggestion because I've watched it within the past few months, and I love it. And Christmas is definitely a through line for the movie because some of the more dramatic set pieces are taking place around Gotham's like Christmas setup or whatever. And honestly, other than The Dark Knight, for me, I think that Batman Returns is the best of the Batman movies. It kind of, even more than the first Tim Burton Batman, it sort of perfectly balances like the darkness of like the Batman story with just a lot of the absurdity that's always been there since like the 1960s TV show, if not even before that. And that's a big part of what's to love about Batman Returns. And then also Danny DeVito as the Penguin, which is just one of the best villains in any superhero movie ever.
And Michelle Pfeiffer as Catwoman, which is just, I mean, oh boy.
Yeah, everything they were trying to do with like the Catwoman movie, like to make Catwoman like super sexy without seeming kind of silly, like they definitely got that right with Batman Returns. Although obviously there are a lot of other problems with Catwoman too, not just that. But yeah, all the characters in that movie work really well, except for maybe Christopher Walken just being Christopher Walken.
Yeah, and I think people forget that movie is about a political campaign. So it also comes up as far as you know, politics movies with was it the Penguin is running for, is it mayor or governor?
he's running for mayor.
Oswald Cobblepot.
All-time great name.
Absolutely fantastic film. Great stunt casting of Pee-wee Herman as Oswald Cobblepot's father in that early scene.
Pushing him into a river.
Yep.
All right, what are you picking there, Chris?
I have some dark ones to, or maybe not dark, but just ones that are further off the beaten path. But
oh, here we go.
I'm going to save those. I'm going to save them because I want my first pick. I want it to be Home Alone.
Oh, good.
The first Home Alone is a really fantastic film. It's put together in a great way. It is absolutely ridiculous. You've got Macaulay Culkin as a star. It's the thing that made him a star after what he'd been in Uncle Buck, I think, before that. Another John Hughes script. The Home Alone, it's a... I assume that everyone listening to this has seen Home Alone, but I would certainly say revisit it. It's solidified its place in the holiday movie Mount Rushmore for me. I remember actually trying to go to the theater the weekend that it came out. We were visiting, I think it came out on Thanksgiving, I want to say, of 1990. And I remember trying to go with my aunt, and it was completely sold out on opening weekend. And it just turned into this absolute, you know, box office juggernaut. And it is, it's really great. And there's so many memeable things about it that I remember very fondly. Uncle Frank is one of the great movie villains in a strange way.
The cheapest bastard possible. Just like shoveling still, I don't know if that's the first one or the second one, but like shoveling silverware into like his wife's purse and just like refusing to pay for like the pizza and just the worst.
I mean, imagine in a healthy functioning family to have your uncle when you're, you know, 12 years old, say, "Look what you did, you little jerk." And the line delivery there is incredible. it's fantastic. The tone of it really has this Three Stooges thing to it. And watching it, you know that you're getting to this huge set piece scenario at the end with the house and all the terrors that are in there, but everything leading up to that and everything just following that really has the perfect amount of heart, but also not cynicism, but a worldliness to it that is really pleasant and kind of balances the charm of it in a way that I think John Hughes was really a tremendous talent at pulling off.
Okay, now I'll tell you that I'm the oldest one here. Mm-hmm. And yep. I did the junket for Home Alone.
Ooh.
And Macaulay Culkin was the cutest kid. I mean, he was really a sharp kid. I'm not saying that he isn't now, but as a little boy, he was very clever. He was very much like the character. And the day that I interviewed him, he came in two different shoes. He wore two different shoes. And I said, "Well, why are you wearing two different shoes?" He said, "I got another pair like this at home." And he said, "Because it's really cool. It's a cool thing to do. You should do that too. Why don't you try that too?" You know, you could tell right then that he wasn't one of those kids who was going to have a bad future. You knew that right. He was savvy enough that he was going to be able to hold his own. And I think he has. I mean, he's been able to walk away from the business. He's richer than a skunk. And he's able to do the things he wants to do at this point. I wish he would do more movies because I think he still has a talent there. But as a kid, he was just the coolest little kid you'd ever see. And you could tell that movie had something about it. There was something there that you knew this was going to last. This wasn't going to be one of those in and out kind of films. And I think a lot of that is John Hughes. John Hughes is the key to so many of those heartfelt things that we loved. If you look back at all of the movies he did, they all kind of struck a nerve. No matter what age you were, you could relate to something there with, just like Christmas Vacation, which he wrote.
And it's the fact that it was a John Hughes script directed by Chris Columbus. I don't know why, but it's just that this perfect intersection of those two talents at the exact time in their career to pull that off with that cast and have it be just, Home Alone. So Home Alone's my first pick. And I feel like that's going to be an absolute home run for anybody. We recently rewatched that and then followed it up with Home Alone 2, which is the ultimate example of a sequel, just taking the exact same plot beats of the first film and then just doing the exact same thing again, more or less, and to, you know, horrifically diminishing returns.
Oh boy. Okay. We'll circle back to that.
Oh no.
He put Home Alone 2 on his list. I bet you any money he did.
Well, I'm looking forward to really getting into it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to pick another John Hughes for my first one, and that's Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Even though it's not Christmas, it is a holiday. Steve Martin's trying to get home at Thanksgiving, and the lovely relationship between Steve and John Candy is just so remarkable. It's such a heartfelt movie that you can't ignore it. And I think it really holds up. It still holds up if you watch it now, but it's more of a Thanksgiving movie. But it still has that holiday vibe to it. And that one was directed by John Hughes, but he didn't like directing. That wasn't his thing.
Chris, you want to hurt me? Go right ahead if it makes you feel any better. I'm an easy target. Yeah, you're right. I talk too much, but I also listen too much.
Okay, so did you take Home Alone 2 as your next one?
No, not quite. My next pick, actually, there's a like kind of a long running at this point. Everybody's aware of it. It's sort of hacky to argue about whether or not Die Hard is a Christmas movie when what people should be talking about in terms of action movies that are sneakily Christmas movies is Lethal Weapon, the original one from 1987, which opens with Jingle Bell Rock. So you check that box off right away. And then it actually ends with a Christmas dinner where Riggs and Murtaugh like fully cement their friendship. When Riggs gives Murtaugh a hollow point bullet that he was going to use to kill himself, just a very cheerful thing to have going on in a holiday movie. And then in between, you know, you get all the great Mel Gibson and Danny Glover, witty dude bro repartee and all the great shootouts. And I think that was one of the earliest Shane Black scripts, right, for a movie that he did, which, I mean, all of his action movies that he's done, even the Predators movie from a couple years ago, are just an absolute blast. And Lethal Weapon is probably the best of them.
Yeah, it has been a long time since I've seen that one, but I totally agree. It is underrated in the canon of action Christmas movies.
Yes.
A lot of those buddy kind of films that they love doing, like Eddie Murphy's Beverly Hills Cop. And I mean, there's a lot of things where they always had some other guy playing off them. And I think that's what we miss with some of these things, is you don't have that other person there, if you know what I mean. And I think this one really works because you do have that really strange thing with Mel and Danny. And I think the two do play off each other really well. Others, not necessarily. They were looking to cast that same kind of dynamic.
I was going to say, Bruce, to your point on that, I don't know if you guys remember either of those, but like, I feel like the nadir of like bad casting for buddy cop stuff was like Hollywood Homicide in the 2000s was Josh Hartnett and Harrison Ford. And then Showtime had Eddie Murphy and Robert De Niro, and both of those were just absolute clunkers with just some terrible pairings.
The ultimate bad example of that was Cop Out by Kevin Smith.
Oh, yeah, God.
Which, the less said about that, the better forever. So I will actually take your Lethal Weapon, and I will raise you another Shane Black script. This time it is Shane Black directing, and it's 2005's Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
You had this on another one, didn't you?
I think so. I believe I'm not sure what I would have had it as.
Maybe honestly, comfort movie or something.
That it might have been it. But Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, it's an LA noir type thing. We might have talked about it when I have talked about The Nice Guys a couple times. And that's, I mean, The Nice Guys and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang are very similar. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is, like I said, directed by Shane Black. And it is Robert Downey Jr. and Val Kilmer are the two main leads. Val Kilmer plays a private detective named Gay Perry, who is in fact a homosexual, and that is played for laughs in a way that is progressive, I think, and could have aged poorly, but rewatching it now, I feel like has aged as well as it could be expected to have aged. And Robert Downey Jr. is a guy who's the fish out of water, in over his head, every man kind of character. And it fits in that very pulpy, book structure, very hard boiled type thing, but with a load of comedy attached to it. And there are so many throwaway lines in this movie that are just tremendous gems. I mean, for example, there's, Robert Downey Jr. is asked at some point early on by another character what he does. And he's like, you know, not much these days. I'm, you know, independently wealthy. I invented dice, you know, it's just this like what? and it just like moves right along. There's no break for a laugh. There's no spotlight put on it, but it is just this incredibly punchy script. To get into the actual plot of it is almost beside the point, because it's very convoluted, and I don't want to say difficult to follow, but I've watched it a bunch of times, and even if I had the space to really get into the plot of it, I don't know how solid I could unspool exactly what's going on. But between Robert Downey and Val Kilmer, it is one of the most charming things, and it doesn't have a lot to do with Christmas other than the fact that it is set during Christmas and fits this theme that way. And it is, if people have not seen it, I encourage them to, because I feel like it came out and just kind of disappeared, but it's fairly underrated gem.
Even though it took a few years, that movie was kind of the beachhead for his full comeback a couple years later for Robert Downey Jr.
To prove that he was capable of making a film after all of his drug problems.
Yeah, and anchor it in that way.
Yeah, he's another rich one. Thank you, Marvel. My second film is going to be Prancer. Do you remember Prancer?
No.
Oh, it was a great kind of American-Canadian film about a little girl who thought for sure she saw the real Prancer from the, from Santa Claus's sleigh. And you got to see it because it's so cute. Sam Elliott is in it. Cloris Leachman's in it. And a little girl, and I don't remember what her name was. But she is certain that she knows Prancer. I've got Prancer. And she gets everybody behind her in the community. It's a darling, darling film. And it's a great one to show kids because kids would get off on it. And they would also find that it leans into the whole Santa Claus myth. So Prancer.
Yeah. And it looks like if anybody wants to track that down, which I will probably put it on at some point, it is on Stars. If anybody has that as a way that they want to watch it. Yeah. Abe Vigoda's in it. Yeah. I just pulled it up. Johnny Galecki, very young Johnny Galecki. This would have been right around the same time that he was in Christmas Vacation.
There you go. Okay, Jared, let's pick another one that isn't Christmas.
My next one, I had to have a Christmas horror movie on my list, and this is one that I sought out after hearing that it was like one of John Waters's like favorite Christmas movies, and it's a movie from 1980 called Christmas Evil. And it's a little bit similar to one that came out later in the 80s called Silent Night, Deadly Night, where it's basically this like deranged man who has like a Santa Claus obsession, eventually spiraling fully out of control and going on a murderous rampage while he's dressed up as Santa Claus. And it's very low budget, but it's really well done. It's not super, super scary. So even if you don't like horror movies that much, you won't have much of a problem watching it. And there's some just like fun, goofy kinds of Christmas stuff in it. And I think it's one of the better movies of just showing, at least in a horror movie, where they can sometimes have problems with the way they handle like deranged people. But it handles the slow, slow descent into madness pretty well, I think, for a low budget movie, horror movie from the 80s. So yeah, Christmas Evil, also known as a Terror in Toyland, is my
Yeah, I'm glad that we have finally managed to talk about a film that has been distributed by the like hardcore exploitation distributors Vinegar Syndrome.
Yes, I have that movie on my shelf, actually. I have that copy of it.
As do I.
You both have it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the main actor, Brandon Maggart.
Yes.
He adds this subtlety to it. I mean, it really is a heavy film, even if it was clearly made on a shoestring. And also, fun fact that I learned while kind of poking around with this movie, he is Fiona Apple's father.
Mind-blowing when I found that out.
Right?
He was a big Broadway star. I remember seeing him on shows in Broadway.
He's great in this.
He really is.
So, Christmas Evil.
Christmas Evil.
I'm gonna take that transition into horror, and I'm going to talk about 1984's absolute classic, Gremlins.
Gremlins. That's a good one.
It's a Joe Dante, one of his, classic films. It's another one that I think everybody has probably seen for the most part. Phoebe Cates, Zach Galligan, and Gizmo the Mogwai. And all hell breaks loose, and it's not necessarily for kids, even though it is very, very much kind of aimed towards a more like a younger demographic, maybe with the cuteness of Gizmo. But yeah, it gets pretty dark and pretty messed up towards the end.
Well, microwaving, wasn't that part of it where they microwaved the gremlins?
Yep. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's pretty, pretty dark.
How old were you when you saw it?
I probably would have seen it actually in maybe high school, because it came out when I was a kid. And I would have only been a couple years old, like very, very young. And, you know, I mean, it took a while for video cassettes and whatnot to be a thing. And so I don't think my parents were really jumping up and down to make sure that I saw Gremlins. So it might've been in high school. It might've been like well into the 90s by the time that I actually saw it, but I've seen it, you know, a dozen times since, and it holds up really fantastic.
Yeah, which is hard to do for some of those 80s movies like that to hold up still.
You didn't have a toy gremlin, did you?
No, I did not.
You know, toys are always the kind of the catch thing. They were, I remember them being some kind of a meal. You got them with a Happy Meal or something. And it was one of those collectible things. You see, that's the benefit of being old. You might have that crap in your basement if you look.
Well, I got to take a peek around or at least Google it up on the eBay.
And I think it was probably trying to hang on the coattails of E.T. because E.T. proved that we really liked all that kind of stuff. So anyway, okay, my next pick, probably because we have the same food groups, is Elf. Will Ferrell's thing where he played the Buddy the Elf. I thought that just, it's so sweet.
We talked about it the last time when we did our food thing, but if like Jon Favreau just kept making like Elf and Chef type movies, that would be like very welcome. It's just a very charming Christmas movie. All the comedy in it holds up well, as it does in a lot of Will Ferrell movies. And yeah, it's just a at this point, obviously a Christmas canon and just always fun to have on.
It's one of the better ones that he's done. There's a lot of junk there in Will Ferrell's resume, but I thought it was a good one. And they've made it into a Broadway musical too, which is probably has been touring around, you know, for a couple of years. And that's not bad either. It's still very cute and the songs are cute. And it's one that you throw it on and the family's around. It holds up. Elf.
And that is on Stars as well.
God, I must be watching Stars all the time.
That's another one where it benefits from such a well-rounded cast. I mean, James Caan is perfect. Bob Newhart, Ed Asner. Zoe Deschanel as the stereotypical manic pixie dream girl type situation there. Her voice is just incredible in that film. I have zero complaints about the film Elf. And like you said, I mean, Jon Favreau, it announced him as a force in Hollywood. And he is, he's probably approaching $1 billion in his bank account by this point, partly on the back of the fact that he was successful with Elf.
The new Walt Disney.
Yeah. I was fascinated to learn how many of the shots are in camera. I mean, they did all of these like forced perspective things in the North Pole to make Buddy look bigger than the other children. And that made the film that much better. I think that they really committed to practical effects.
They did that in the Harry Potter films too, with, is it Hagrid? Is that his name? And it was just a matter of putting the people at the other end of the table and him at the front. And that's how they were able to make that look like he's bigger than everybody else.
So Jared.
Yes, it's me again. And Robert Altman's come up on a number of episodes at this point. And somebody else that I feel like we've mentioned in a number of different episodes, mostly Chris mentioning him, I think. But I had to pick Bad Santa by Terry Zwigoff from 2003. Which is definitely one of, if not the darkest Christmas comedies that's been made. It's still one of my favorite holiday movies, and I think it's one of the best. It might be the best showcase for Billy Bob in a movie. He's so sleazy in so much of the movie, but he's still weirdly charming and likable. And there's a lot of cynicism in the movie, but there's actually some Christmas cheer and mirth too. And I appreciate that about Bad Santa. And then also, my parents actually wanted to leave the theater when we saw Bad Santa around Christmas time in 2003. So I have that very distinct memory attached to that movie.
I love Bad Santa. I think it's real. That has the right kind of attitude, perhaps. You know, there's one this year, Fat Man, I think it's called, with Mel Gibson, that has a very similar kind of theme to it.
Yeah. Terry Zwigoff has come up in the past when I think I mentioned Crumb as one of my, like, we were talking about documentaries or something along those lines. And Terry Zwigoff directed that documentary about R. Crumb, and Bad Santa.
Not a long filmography that he has, but a pretty good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I agree. Billy Bob Thornton is magnetic in his decrepitude in that film.
You remember Bad Santa 2? That wasn't that bad, was it?
I still haven't seen it.
I don't think it was as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah, I've just been too anxious to ever see that one, because certain sequels to stuff I just don't ever want to see if they haven't gotten the best reviews, because I just don't want to ruin or cheapen the first one.
Home Alone 4.
No, thank you. I actually have a Billy Bob Thornton connection to my next pick. My next pick is from 2005, just a couple years after Bad Santa, is a movie called The Ice Harvest, starring John Cusack and Billy Bob Thornton. It is very similar to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in that it has kind of a convoluted noir, hard-boiled, pulpy plot to it. John Cusack is a mob lawyer, and Billy Bob Thornton is this like strip club owner, and they have just stolen a couple million dollars, but they're trapped in Wichita Falls during an ice storm on Christmas Eve. And it's all about the crosses and double crosses that have to do with the two of them trying to escape this town. It is directed by Harold Ramis very, very well. Groundhog Day, Caddyshack, National Lampoon's Vacation. Harold Ramis was a comedy genius, and The Ice Harvest is no exception. And it just kind of, I think, fell between the cracks for a lot of people. And I have championed this film a whole lot. It's a hard R, so it's not exactly a family film, and it has a kind of a bitterness to it a little bit, but it's fantastic. Billy Bob Thornton, like I said, is incredible. And my absolute favorite thing about this film is Oliver Platt, who just chews the scenery as this drunken buffoon, entitled, you know, just despicable person, and fantastic, fantastic film.
There's a little Christopher Walken in him.
Yes.
Where someday you're going to say, does that all he do? Is that the kind of character he always is? But yeah, those hammy ones like that, they're fun.
Yep. It's, if anybody wants to track that down, which I do encourage, is on Peacock. If you've got a subscription there, or I think it's free. So I'm sure there'll be commercials or something, but go for it. Bruce.
I'm going to pick Charlie Brown's Christmas.
Perfect.
Because it's got to be on there somewhere, right? Didn't you grow up with that at some point? And just even when you look back at that, at what they were able to create, not knowing what they were getting, because it was a newspaper cartoon. How do you turn that into something on television? And they hit so many high points with that production. It's unbelievable. And the idea that they would use adults as just kind of background noise, I think is very inventive and creative, and I can still watch it every year and still get the same kind of emotional pitch that I got back then. And I think it is out there now somewhere. Didn't they take it off the networks and it's on something else?
There was some rights thing. I think it was, cause I think ABC or such and such still has one of the networks still has the rights to it. And so they pulled it off of the other places, or it wasn't good. Anyway, there was some hubbub about it, and it's out there now.
You have to look for it. Yeah.
I have it on DVD. I'm sure other people do. It's one of those ones where you go ahead and own it. It's never going to get old. And while you're, you know, on Amazon or whatever, or, you know, going to your local place to buy it, pick up the soundtrack, because that Vince Guaraldi soundtrack is unbeatable.
Yeah, that's I was going to say, that's one that it's kind of been funny to watch in my lifetime. One that's become just like the go-to for like very trendy, like music people to go to as their default like Christmas soundtrack. Because, yeah, it's one of the best soundtracks for any movie ever. All of the music in that is just perfect.
Yeah. Bruce, do you want to go ahead and give your last one as well, just to make sure in the event that you have to jet?
I do have to run, but – It has to be Christmas Story. I know you guys might hate it.
Oh, no.
I will watch that when it's on a loop on TNT or TBS and watch, because Ralphie is like my spirit animal. I really think he captures what I remember childhood to be like. And when all of that crap goes wrong and we get the major award, it's just so classic and perfect. And when he goes and sees Santa Claus and Santa Claus gives him the boot, because I do remember Santa Claus being kind of mean. And I was scared to death of Santa Claus in the early years. I thought, oh my God, who is this guy? Because it was like somebody hiding behind. Santa Claus was a scary creature to me, and I really didn't care for that. And so when Santa Claus is kicking little Ralphie down the slide, I thought, oh my God, that is what I remember Santa Claus being, kind of evil.
Bruce, you saying that reminds me of when I was a kid. I went to Chuck E. Cheese a lot because there was one close to my grandma's house. And I, after a while, one of the times I was really scared of the Chuck E. Cheese like costume performer, and I actually knocked the Chuck E. Cheese costume performer over into the ball pit.
Oh no! Did his head come off?
No.
And then did he come after you?
No, they weren't happy with that. But yeah, that so I that was my childhood fear of those sorts of figures.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I even remember when they had Santa Claus masks that were not like just a beard. It was like a mask. And I don't know, there was something about Santa Claus that I wasn't too keen on. So the idea that he would kick a kid down a slide, that's my Santa Claus.
Yep. And it's the same thing with all of the nightmares that Ralphie has about the BB gun. Also the homebrewed Wizard of Oz related paraphernalia that's on everybody, all the weird, you know, flying monkey type thing.
And the teacher, then the teacher goes to the classroom and says, A, you know, and he's thinking he's going to get this grade A. And was it a C or a C plus that he got on his essay?
Yeah.
By the way, you picked A Christmas Story. Do you remember who directed A Christmas Story? Because we've talked about him on here before.
It's the Porky's guy.
Yeah, who also did a Black Christmas, Bob Clark. So yeah. Not only does he have the best Christmas horror movie ever, he has one of the most iconic just general Christmas movies ever too, which I think is hilarious.
So it must have played into his whole life that Christmas was a big thing.
No kidding. Yeah, because those two, that's like the dichotomy of Christmas, the joy and the terror of Christmas in two movies.
Yeah, Bob Clark's career is fascinating. I mean, between Christmas Story and
Porky.
Yeah, and Porky. But he did all the Baby Geniuses and Super Babies. He also directed Rhinestone with Sylvester Stallone and Dolly Parton, who we were circling back to. What a fascinating guy. Bruce, I mean, your last two, Charlie Brown Christmas and Christmas Story. I mean, those are classics for a reason. I still have a sentimental place in my heart for both of those. And there's a reason why they've lasted, and it's because they have a heart to them. And I mean, you look at Charlie Brown Christmas, the fact that it actually goes back to the original Bible story and says, you know, this is what the holiday is about. While everyone is getting distracted by these other things. And, you know, it's the same with A Christmas Story, that it ends up with being all about family and eating the Chinese food.
It doesn't matter how you celebrate. It's that you're celebrating with others.
Yes.
That's a nice kind of sentiment that's present. And even when we're alone during this kind of year, it's a nice kind of warm feeling when you put one of those on. It reminds you of Christmases you may have had in the past or what that whole feeling is all about.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm too old school, but I do like that stuff.
So I know you got to go.
I'm leaving you.
It's just you and me, Jared.
Perfect. We can have it out. Although, is it my turn now or is it yours?
It is. Let's do, because we only have one each to go, right?
Well, my next and final pick, my favorite Christmas movie of all time. I watch it every year. I have copies of it on DVD, Blu-ray, VHS, every possible format. I probably have a Betamax of it. It's the only movie on any of our lists that features a U.S. president. And that is Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, directed by Chris Columbus from 1992. Of course, Trump shows up in that movie when Kevin is asking for directions and says, down the hall and to the right. I remember that mundane line. I remember so many lines from that movie. I've watched it dozens of times. And you were saying earlier, remind me again exactly what your criticism was of Home Alone 2 versus the first one.
My criticism of it was mainly that it is a complete retread of the first film. And in doing so, kind of loses a lot of the soul. And I don't know. I mean, there's just something in the first Home Alone. One of the things that has always resonated with me was the neighbor and the whole thing with his kid, or his family that he's been estranged from. And that, you know, being the kicker to the whole movie. Whereas with this, I mean, the pigeon lady is fine. But just doesn't have that same like punch to it.
I actually like, the pigeon lady a little bit more than the shoveler from the first one. It maybe is a little bit more on the nose because she's just kind of unnamed and I don't know if she's homeless or she just chooses to live in Central Park. But I don't know. I find her just a little bit more soulful even than the shoveler from the first one. You're definitely right. It is a retread, but that's kind of what I like about it because, like, one of the things that's a joy about, like, any of the Home Alone movies is that in some ways it's just a live-action version of Tom and Jerry. Like, If it wasn't a kid's movie, Home Alone would be like one of the most violent movies ever, the stuff that happens in it. But within the confines of the series, it's just these really goofy, like, booby traps. And I think the booby traps in the second one are way better than the first one. And that's one of the things I always liked the most about it as a kid, especially the tool chest, like falling down the stairs and just slamming. I think it's Marv. Marv's the one that gets both of them do. They just get slammed into the door. And then I do think also the secondary characters are a little bit better overall in the second one. I know John Candy's not in the second one, and that's a loss. But Tim Curry is just a perfect, like, little villain in his role. And honestly, I think he's more villainous in some ways than Marv or Harry actually are in the second one with the way that he behaves. Even Rob Schneider, who I don't like in almost anything he's ever been in, I think he's really funny in that little part as the bellhop, like asking for a tip and only getting, was it bubble or zebra stripe gum or whatever. So it is definitely a retread. That part I do acknowledge, but I think that's why I like it. It's because they realized all the stuff that, worked about the first one and then they just like turbocharged it.
I mean, we're just going to have to agree to disagree, which is perfectly fine.
Yeah, that's one I can talk about forever.
Yeah. And I mean, and it still is very, it still is iconic for so many reasons. Part of it is that it's, you know, people watch it right on the heels of the first Home Alone. And so I think it is as wedged into the, you know, pop culture consciousness as much. But yeah, to me, it's not going to get there. And it's also, it's really weird to see him. Like there's that one like helicopter shot of him on top of the Trade Center.
Yeah. I was going to mention that. And then also I was just going to say definitely like iconic movie poster with Marv and Harry peering out from behind a skyscraper and Kevin like looking into a newspaper. I've always loved that part of it too, but yeah, it is kind of actually a pretty good New York movie, at least in terms of just hitting all the iconic stuff from that time period. Cause like he spends time at Rockefeller Center. He's on top of the World Trade Center at one point. I feel like I'm missing some. Oh, yeah, the Central Park stuff is kind of nice. Like it's a nice little sampling of New York towards that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So my last pick is Trading Places, 1983, directed by John Landis. It stars Dan Aykroyd, Eddie Murphy, Jamie Lee Curtis, all three pretty much at the absolute pinnacle of their careers when they all had the absolute most juice in Hollywood, as well as just talent. I mean, Eddie Murphy, Dan, I mean, it's Jamie Lee Curtis is gorgeous in this movie, even though she plays a prostitute, Eddie Murphy is one of, you know, the most magnetic actors in Hollywood at that time. Dan Aykroyd, yeah, perfectly cast as this, you know, just rich dolt. And yeah, they all just kind of zip through this whole thing. And it's also, I mean, so the basic plot of Trading Places is Dan Aykroyd is some, you know, Philadelphia investment banker guy, whatever. And Eddie Murphy is a very charming hobo, I guess is the most polite way to say it. Con artist, I guess maybe is the other one. And Dan Aykroyd's bosses are just going to flip things and just replace Dan Aykroyd with Eddie Murphy's character and vice versa. And just see if they can thrive in that scenario, and they make a bet on it. And I'm again very, very much oversimplifying the situation here, but
Randolph and Mortimer Duke are basically the Koch brothers. Like, that's kind of what, like, if the movie was made now, people would have thought that's what, like, they were riffing on in terms of them being these just like obscenely wealthy brothers who just like to meddle in like social affairs.
Yep.
Like, that's what they would have the feel of now. And yeah, basically the fact that everything in this movie happens because they make a bet about nature versus nurture is just, it's absurd.
It's not even subtext that the film is about class and race in ways that honestly in 2020 still resonate.
Yeah.
I mean, that might sound ridiculous, but when you watch it, I mean, the stuff that they're going into, I mean, it's the 1%, and kind of pulls the curtain back. And it's a fable in its own way. But you know, it pulls the curtain back on just, I mean, the fact that the 1% are all empty suits for the most part. I mean, you look at, you know, all the people that are running corporations and, why do they deserve the money that they're getting paid? And could anybody else do that? And this movie is like, well, yeah. Like, I mean, it's, you know, everyone kind of gets where they're at through breeding and through social climbing to a degree. I mean, obviously Eddie Murphy's character is pretty unique amongst other, you know, potential con artists working the rough and tumble streets of Philadelphia in the early 80s. And it's another one where the supporting cast is incredible. Al Franken and Tom Davis show up. I mean, this is practically an SNL movie in a way.
Frank Oz shows up. Yep. Speaking of the Muppets.
As a police officer, saying pretty much some of the same lines that he has in Blues Brothers, which came out a couple of years earlier. And I like the idea of the Blues Brothers and Trading Places existing in the same timeline. Like they're in the same plane, and Frank Oz has just gone from working Joliet prison to, you know, being a, you know, desk cop intake person at some Philadelphia police station.
I'm curious, apparently originally this was, which makes a lot of sense, that it was supposed to be at one point Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder.
Huh.
How do you think that would have stacked up versus what we got? Because I think that would have worked almost just as well. Obviously you're doing counterfactuals, but I mean, that would have been a great pairing for this same kind of idea too, which they eventually kind of did, but
I think, I mean, it would have been more subtle.
Yeah.
Not to say that Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy are bad actors. They're great actors, but they're much more broad. And, you know, Dan Aykroyd, when he's playing this, you know, snooty rich guy, is a real snooty rich guy, the stereotypical version of that. And Eddie Murphy is a very stereotypical, charming hustler type. And yeah. I think if it was Pryor and Wilder, it just would have been a lot more tamped down. But Trading Places, 1983. Wonderful film.
Whew. All right. Well, I think that's the list. And I think we got a pretty good sampling of a lot of different holiday moods and vibes.
I mean, there just are so many great movies that have to do with Christmas. The pendulum is swung pretty far from the, you know, Christmas Story and Charlie Brown Christmas all the way to something like Christmas Evil.
Christmas Evil was one I was thinking about, but I bogarted that a little bit once I was on Letterboxd and I saw that you would watch that. And I was like, oh yeah, I've seen that and I love that movie. And that's a one that definitely needs to be shouted out because it's a very buried kind of gem.
It was on my list as something where if you didn't claim it, I was going to jump in with it, but
yeah,
I figured you were going to do it justice. So yeah, so next time around, make sure that you are subscribed to the show on whatever your service is of choice, and you'll hear our list of top movies from 2020.
Gonna be a lot of Invisible Man.
It's just gonna be Bad Boys 3 in every single spot.
Bad Boys 3, Invisible Man, the Harley Quinn movie.
Yeah. Do you have anything to promote? You got any articles that are out there?
We're getting down to the end of the year now, and so we put together like collections and stuff like that. And I know people listening to this that don't live in Mason City might be a little less interested, but I pulled together a collection of some stories of mine that, even though they're set like in and around here, I think they kind of get at some like larger stuff. And I tried to pick stories for my collection that weren't all COVID. Actually, I made a point of not picking any COVID specific stories for what I put together. So that was the main thing I've done and put together recently that I was pretty happy with how it turned out. So I'm plugging year-end collections for the Globe Gazette, which is the paper that I write for.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Jared, and talk to you again in 2 weeks. All right, so that is the end of the episode. You can check the show notes for links to where you can stream the movies that we talked about, discover older episodes, and hey, you know, find ways to contact Bruce, Jared, myself if you want. Our next episode will be about our favorite films of 2020, so make sure that you are subscribed to get that delivered once it posts out to the world. The show is produced by myself, Bruce, and Jared, and I'm the one who records and edits it. As always, thank you all so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show and are taking care of yourselves out there.